Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Well, good morning. Music usually means Carrie Miller on NPR News, but today, Tom Cran here at the State Fair, at the State Fairgrounds, where we are overcast and 63 degrees with a live broadcast. Thanks for joining us in person here at the fair and on the air. Now, you can find a lot of things here at the fair, from the fried foods and the buckets of cookies to the thrill rides, death-defying as they are. Many of them may be fun, but they're not always the healthiest choices. But it's becoming a nice, healthy tradition here at the fair to have Dr. John Hallberg here, a tradition that's always a pleasure as well. You hear John on All Things Considered most Tuesdays. So many Tuesdays, in fact, that just last week, John came into the studio for his 500th medical conversation on All Things Considered. So we thought we'd celebrate by spending an hour here at the fair booth here at Minnesota Public Radio. John, in addition to being our regular medical analyst here on All Things Considered, or usually on All Things Considered, I'm used to saying that, of course, is an associate professor at the University of Minnesota and medical director of the Mill City Clinic. And John, thanks for coming out to the fair again.
It's always good to talk to you. Thank you, Tom. It's so great to be here.
So 500 medical chats. We're going to get to what we've talked about and how this all came about. Coming up, we're going to have people be able to join the conversation either from the fair here or on the phone as well. But here I want to talk about what's at the top of the news, because one of the conversations that we had, actually I think there were four of them total, from Louisiana back in, after Hurricane Katrina, about a month or so after, or weeks
about
after?
2 weeks, yeah.
2 weeks. You went down as part of a medical reserve corps to provide care in Louisiana. So as we look at what's going on in Texas, the floodwaters are far from receding here. Tell us what's going to happen there when it comes to medical care, and what from your experience in Katrina is sort of coming back to you now as you watch this?
Sure. I mean, so right now, obviously, they're just trying to save lives and get people out of flooded homes and flooded areas.
Yeah.
But imagine that your home is flooding rapidly. You're literally being told to get on the roof and not go through the attic. If you're in the process of doing that, you do not have time to grab things that you need. And so one of the things that we discovered a couple weeks after Hurricane Katrina went through the southern Louisiana is that people left without their medications. And it's pretty amazing how people with hypertension, high blood pressure, diabetes, mental health issues, suddenly needing their prescriptions. And so I think once the waters recede a little bit, once people get settled, that'll be one of the first things to do, is try and get people back on their medications, which they left behind.
What do they not know that they're going to need, do you think, the medical infrastructure?
Yeah, I mean, it's just so when we went down, and I was part of the Medical Reserve Corps from the University of Minnesota, we went down in a very structured deployment with our friends from the Mayo Clinic, College of St. Catharines, a Jewish relief organization. And by that point, there was some sense of what was going on. People, the Red Cross, had come in, had converted anything and everything into shelters.
And members of Minnesota Red Cross are headed down there this morning.
To do just that. So and you can imagine every park, every place, think of the state fairgrounds here, the dairy building, the Coliseum. Suddenly you look at everything with a different eye. You think, like, that could house how many hundreds of people could be in that building.
Wow.
And so sanitation's a huge issue. One of the things we did is we did a lot of immunizations. We gave a lot of tetanus shots because, tetanus is a soil contaminant. We gave a lot of hepatitis A immunizations. And if you now have tons and tons of people in crammed spaces, you do start to wonder about or worry about meningitis, for example. So they may be giving meningitis immunizations. So immunizations, medications, just the daily things. And then imagine all the nursing homes and hospitals that have to be closed. So now you've got people who require incredible care that has to be delivered elsewhere. So suddenly you're converting other spaces into makeshift nursing homes and hospitals.
If I remember right from the time you were there when we talked about it, you set out really not knowing what you thought it might be a lot of emergency medical treatment, and it turned out that it was a lot of routine medical treatment that had either been delayed or unable to provide because of the conditions.
Well, and one of the things we discovered is just how poor much of the population of New Orleans was, and how little, for example, diabetic education people had ever had. So suddenly our diabetic nurse educators are with us. We're giving people their very first ever you know, really good one-to-one, you know, session on diabetic care. And people who needed dialysis couldn't get dialysis. And so I think that was the thing we discovered there, was just the depth of poverty and the role that that plays in people's health. And suddenly whatever little infrastructure was there was gone.
Are we likely to see Minnesotans and some of your colleagues make the trip down there? Do you think there'll be a call for that?
I think there's going to be a call at some point. I don't know if the Medical Reserve Corps, which is part of the Homeland Security.
Yeah, tell us about the Medical Reserve Corps. How is that structured and what is it?
So at the University of Minnesota, since we have six schools, health-related schools, and thousands upon thousands of people with healthcare training, it makes it a logical place to have a corps like that that can be called up in a national emergency, which it seems like this will be. But also counties do that. Other schools do that. And it's a very structured organization, and we will see if we're called.
So as you see this, what do you think the first thing, the first call is going to be for?
Just like it is right now, I think the Red Cross will be shelter. Shelter and sanitation are probably the two things that need to be provided right now. People need to have a safe, clean, dry place to be. And then after that, the other issues will come in, such as getting people back on the medications which they left behind.
Yeah. Dr. John Hallberg, our guest for the hour from the Minnesota State Fair. And you can join the conversation, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828 or here at the fair. We're going to take some of your questions a little later on in the hour. This isn't aches and pains and doctor, they can't figure out what's wrong with me. We'll have time to talk about that. It's not healthcare policy. It's not the Affordable Care Act. We've had lots of conversations about that. But questions sparked by our discussion here about where we've been in the future of medicine. And I want to get you thinking about all of that and the topics that we've talked about in the news. So, John, as we look back, 500 topics here. Now, the very first one was back in September of 2003. And you and I could talk about this today, 500 topics later. And we probably could fill the hour with this. And that is direct-to-consumer advertising of drugs. In the 14 years, what's changed about that and what's the same?
Well, back in 2003, I had just come back from testifying before the Food and Drug Administration about this very topic. We had done a small study at the University of Minnesota and a couple of our satellite clinics looking at how many people actually made an appointment with their provider to talk about a drug that they saw advertised. Mm-hmm. And it was somewhere in the single-digit, you know, percent area, something like 6% or 8%. But keep in mind, that's a lot more than I see with pneumonia, for example.
Yeah, right. Okay.
So it's a significant number of people were coming in for that reason.
And that's because of the tagline. Ask your doctor
Absolutely. If
it's right for you, right? So people are literally doing that.
Absolutely. In 2003, that was sort of a new concept. Now we all know that this is just embedded in our advertising, and it almost becomes a joke because when they go through all the side effects, we just almost laugh at, at this litany of, like, why would you ever take that medication?
Exactly.
To say that's nothing of the fact that it's never covered by your insurance plan when it's a brand new medication, but that's another story. But yes, it's absolutely as relevant today as it was 14 years ago.
And it has changed, hasn't it? Because I see some of these medications, and I've never even heard of these conditions. When you're watching any kind of network news,
Tom, nor have I. Sometimes I'm in the business. I don't know what they're advertising or why they're advertising it.
Why they're advertising it? And some of them are really pretty specialized.
Oh yeah,
you know, things.
Well, I was the thing that really. I really ponder about is when there's a, you know, you've got cancer and they're suggesting you take a specific medication for your cancer. Don't you think that your oncologist would probably have already suggested that if it was actually appropriate that you're on that medication? So I think just the whole idea of that is sort of ridiculous. And I do, you know, obviously it works. They would not be doing this if it doesn't help, you know, drive sales.
And am I right that in other countries, let's say European countries, that this is just not allowed? This is that these drugs are not advertised this way, but people get their medications through their doctor.
It's even more dramatic than that. I think there's literally like two or three countries in the world that allow this, and we're one of them. I mean, so it's such a uniquely American thing that we encourage consumers, we encourage patients to ask for a specific expensive, sometimes not that well proven medication.
And am I right when I watch it and I say, all right, that's sometimes the commercials are 2 minutes or minute anyway. And I'm thinking on network time,
two minutes,
we're talking tens of, if not hundreds of thousands for each one of these commercials. And then I'm thinking, well, that they pass those costs on to all of us, right? Am I right about
that? Well, they have to, right? I mean, and there's, you know, there's this is a multi-billion dollar industry and campaign with stakes that are huge.
But at the same time, there are medications that are helping people, and people might have heard of that through an ad and might get some relief from it, right? I mean, it's not a whole...
Oh, there's no question. I mean, I think back to, you know, NPR is 50 years old. So go back to 1967, and I'm thinking specifically about mental health medications.
Right.
The tiny number of meds that we had with horrible side effects. And now think of where we are. So there's no question that better pharmaceuticals have made us healthier, have given us better lives. So I think that's an important distinction, you know, that there are terrific medications out there. But it's this paradox that when a medication's brand new, not covered by insurance, maybe hasn't truly been proven to be that effective yet, we don't fully know the side effects that are out there. That's a challenge. You know, eventually that drug will become proven, will become generic, will become more affordable, and will truly, truly help potentially millions of people's lives.
And I'm thinking of one that we actually talked about when it came out. And then I know people who have used this medication and they've stopped smoking. The medication is a Chantix or whatever. And that was on TV for a while. And there are people whose lives are healthier because they're not smoking now because that medication worked.
Oh, absolutely. Before that, it was Zyban, which is also known as bupropion. So absolutely. I mean, gosh, if we have medications like that that can help people quit smoking, what a great public health triumph that can be.
Let's talk about what has changed in this 14 years that you've been doing this with us here on NPR News. I'm talking with Dr. John Hallberg live from the State Fair. And one of the things I think is the way mental health is talked about, the way it is maybe not treated, although perhaps, but it's a bigger part of our conversation. It's a bigger part of your conversations with patients, I think, over time. And would you say the attitudes have changed about it in the general public?
I think so. I think that our understanding of neuroscience, the imaging studies that we can now do, I think there's been a huge improvement in terms of just how we talk about mental health. I think there's been a destigmatization of it. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was a medical student, I suffered from panic attacks, panic disorder. I'm very open about that. I share that with medical students and as they go through their rigorous training, which can be, you know, a terrifying experience. And I think that, you know, and we've had some very high-profile suicides over the years, and not that they were inherently preventable, but I think that talking about them and encouraging people to ask for help, we have better medications, better techniques. I think there's a lot going on in the world of mental health and neuroscience that's helped change that.
And also, is it more integrated into overall health and less segmented as, you know, as they used to say, get your head examined?
Absolutely. I mean, I think
you used to use these terms that are no longer in.
Think of how absurd, in a way, what an absurd idea to think that our brain is somehow a different organ than our heart or our liver or our kidneys. You know, we don't stigmatize people with heart disease or liver disease or kidney disease. Why do we stigmatize people with a brain disease or a brain disorder? And I think of mental health as being that, or mental illness as being that. Sometimes it you know, needs a combination of talk therapy and support and possibly medication or other treatments. You know, and in terms of just integrating it, it's almost now a vital sign. When people go to the clinic, they're often asked a couple questions about depression. And so that just goes to show we put it right up there with blood pressure and temperature and oxygen level and a few other things.
We're talking with Dr. John Hallberg about some themes that have come out of the 500 conversations we've had. I think I've had most of those with you, John. 430
the
500?
I think 460. Yeah.
60,
Tom.
Is it? Yep, yep. Anyway, we're talking about those themes, and there's a lot, obviously, in 500 conversations. But another one that has come up, and that is chronic pain. Treatment for chronic pain, which is often painkillers, opioids. Now we're dealing with an opioid crisis in the year 2017. I found 11 different topics about pain meds, about prescription medication versus other treatments. Even back in 2006, and I think this is just a horrible thing now, knowing what we know about opioids, there was marketed a narcotic lollipop, an opioid on a stick, as it were. And we talked about that. It was actually fentanyl, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
That is not a thing anymore.
Well,
really,
I mean, there's a version. Yeah, there's a version that's out there, but it's you know, clearly for patients with end-stage cancer. I mean, it's got a very unique niche. But just this idea of, you know, in kind of the press at the time, it was being referred to as an opioid lollipop. And I think it just kind of came at a time when we were really being admonished astonished for not taking pain more seriously, that we were under-treating people's pain. And that was the message that we were getting. And I think many of us in the trenches heeded the message. We did a better job, so we thought, of treating people with chronic pain. In fact, I'll never forget. I mean, you know, the guidelines were try acetaminophen first for older people, and if that doesn't work, that's Tylenol. Yeah. If that doesn't work, go to opioids, you know, often like right before away, anti-inflammatories. Right, and like, wow. Oh my gosh, to think that we were actually doing that. And so I think that we collectively are paying the price for that now with people who are abusing the medication. And one of the pieces that's subtle and tricky about this is that many people receive a prescription for Vicodin, let's say. They've had some teeth extracted from the dentist. They get 20, 30 tablets. They use two. That bottle sits in your cabinet, and it's very easy for someone in the family or friends to take it. And that's what happens. And then people, it becomes sort of a gateway drug to stronger things like heroin.
So how is it changing? And how is your approach in the clinic changing from the age of only 11 years ago of the try Tylenol and then here's some Percocet?
So I think that we are just, I mean, I think we've really hit the skids on this. I mean, I think that, you know, maybe too much so that when people are in pain, maybe more people are suffering. But I think we're really stopping new prescriptions to a large extent. I know at my clinic, for example, if we have a new patient who's coming to our clinic and they ask for an opioid, they just don't get it. And by nipping it in the bud like that, that eliminates doctor shopping or clinic shopping. So you can't do that. We have a state registry. We can actually look up now. Back in the day, we had to keep sort of illegal lists in the emergency rooms of people who are frequent flyers that who would come in and specifically ask for these. You weren't allowed to do that, but of course there was such a list. But now it's out in the open.
We because can look they were known to you. They were known people who came in.
Oh, absolutely. You know, pharmacies or clinics would call each other and let them know that someone's, you know, seems to be abusing things. But now it's much more out there. We have people sign pain contracts. We're looking at alternatives, looking more holistically at treating pain, physical therapy, yoga, massage therapy, acupuncture, all those things. So it really has changed clearly for the better for the overwhelming majority of people involved with chronic pain.
Another topic that's come up with us is vaccinations. And this is in the news just, Friday, that there have been no cases of measles here in Minnesota in 42 days.
That's right.
Is the time that they can declare the epidemic over, right?
Right.
But are you surprised we're still talking about it as much as we are?
No.
No, okay.
No, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I think you and I talked about this. As long as there's the internet and as long as anyone sows even a tiny bit of doubt or casts some sort of sense like, I think that this is unsafe or I think there's too much mercury in there or something, then I think we're wired for that, especially in this sort of internet age. It just stirs something. And if you're a parent and you have a young child and you don't want that child to get autism, you know, of course you're going to do everything you can to prevent that from happening. But it's not science, you know, and that's the trouble. And but I mean, I just had an older gentleman the other day who did not want to get a pneumonia shot or an influenza shot because he just has doubts, he has concerns. And we can argue with people like that. I try and impress upon reason, but at the same point, you know, at some point, you just have to kind of move on because people, their views are so deeply held, you're not going to sway them. But we can try
something like pneumonia shot. That's not a schedule of immunizations that you would give to a child, right?
Although, is it? Yeah, it's a pneumococcal vaccine we actually give young children. And it's in a huge, you know, in a hugely important job of reducing forms of meningitis, for example. People think of it as like an ear infection shot, and it's not. It's really more of a meningitis preventing shot.
So that's what you would, that's on the schedule for children.
Absolutely.
But then there was, we talked more than once about this Dr. Wakefield in the UK. And it was his work that falsely linked, we should say, autism and vaccines. It's been debunked. It was the journal, is it Lancet, that published it, just rescinded it, which was unprecedented, right?
Unprecedented.
They said this is, when you look him up on Wikipedia, which I did to check as prepared, it says right away, you know, debunked. I mean, it's like in the first sentence. Okay. Why is that not enough for people to say, you know, that scare is not real. That was debunked. The science was bad.
Well, I think that for some people, science is like faith, right? You can't see a virus. You can't see an antibody level. You can't see these things. You just have to take it, you know, for what it's worth. Now, that's, I mean, we can argue with, you know, what is science, but it's proven. I mean, you've done studies that are deep and broad, and not just one study, but many studies, and you do these, you know, analyses analyses of studies, meta-analyses, to you know, get at the point where you have your truth, your scientific truth. And I think that, but you know, when you're in a community and you just don't buy it, and then he's your ally. I mean, someone like that, he's speaking your language, and it's like, see, there's somebody that really knows the truth, and that becomes very challenging and very tricky.
There was concern with the measles outbreak in the Twin Cities, and now we're at a place where there have been no cases. So is that a public health success there? Did the word get out, get your kids vaccinated in the end, or?
It just sort of burns out. I mean, that's what outbreaks or epidemics do, is they can sort of burn out. I'm afraid that that's probably the thing. I think that public health officials are upset. I mean, I think they're very frustrated that this happened in the first place. This should not be happening in Minnesota in 2017, and it did.
And why, fear?
Well, fear, and people are not getting their children. I mean, the vast majority of the cases reported were people who had never received the measles immunizations, and those who did were exposed to people who were infected.
The theory, if you can do it quickly, of herd immunity here, when people read, well, you know, the flu vaccine, it's only, what, 60% effective or whatever. Why is it that important? We're talking about that public health theory of herd immunity, right?
So you can never immunize 100% of a population. You just can't do it. It's impossible to get to everybody. But if you get to a majority, a vast majority, an 80, 90% range, somewhere in there, if you're a virus and you're trying to land on a person and find a nice home, a nice warm, humid home in your nose or throat, and you land and it's like, oh, I can't land there because that person's been immunized, and I can't land over here, that person's been immunized. It gets harder if you're from a viral perspective, you know, to find a home, a host. And so at some point when you have 80, 90% of the population that's been immunized, it just can't take hold, and you can stop the spread to a large extent.
Dr. John Hallberg here with me at the Minnesota State Fair as we're bringing you a live broadcast here on NPR News. We want you in on this as well. Call us at 1-800-242-2828 or 651-227-6000 or email us at talk@mprnews.org. That's another way to get in touch. We're going to take some questions. And again, these aren't it's not about healthcare reform, healthcare coverage, but more about these ideas of what we've been talking about on the topics that we've discussed, John and I, in our 500 conversations on All Things Considered. And that's why we're here, to celebrate that and get us thinking. We're going to look ahead in just a moment or two as well about the future of healthcare in the clinic and who the doctor might be when you go to the doctor or practitioner over time. But first, Mike and Edina called and just wanted to know this, John, about, again, getting back to the situation in Texas with Harvey, the long-term effects of flooding or extreme weather, and when it comes to things like, for example, molds and even mental trauma.
Oh, sure. I mean, think of the post-traumatic stress quality of this. I mean, I think of just you know that this hurricane's coming. You had no idea the degree of flooding. You have no time to leave with anything. Your house is destroyed. Think of those pictures of New Orleans when people went back and the amount of mold that was there. I mean, certainly there's that impact with that. It's catastrophic.
We'll continue to hear about it and continue to cover it here on NPR News, too. We'll get a news update in a moment or two on that with the latest and throughout the day. But let's talk about the future here. And before we get there, I want to go back to the past and your medical training, not the far distant past. We're talking here about starting in the late 80s and early 90s, right?
Yeah.
Give us a baseline of what that was like for you. I know it's a big topic in a small amount of time.
Sure. So, I mean, you know, I went to medical school for 4 years. I did family medicine residency for 3 years. That structure has not really changed. Most medical students still go to med school for 4 years. The first 2 years are what we call the preclinical years, a lot of studying, a lot of learning. I liken it to learning the language of medicine. Okay. You're learning the building blocks. You're learning how to speak this language. Understand first how the body's put together in a normal way. And then the second year is largely spent in how the body fails, which is a kind of horrifying thing to think about. But it's called human disease. Is this thread course that goes through the entire year. And they basically learn how every single organ system doesn't work. And then the next 2 years are spent basically doing the clinical work and learning to become a doctor, being on the wards, being in the clinics, and seeing patients. And then you specialize in something. I specialize in family medicine. Others do pediatrics, internal medicine, things like that. The fundamental training hasn't changed a lot. The thing that has changed the most in that time since I was in training is this computer, the electronic mm-hmm. record, the
you got one
access
right in front
to everything.
Of me. Yeah,
that has
yeah.
completely, fundamentally, for good and bad, changed yeah. Everything that we do.
Really? So that's what you point to first of the experience. That
no
has
question.
Changed. And I also want to ask you about, have you had a chance to meet with the students already this year who are coming in that you'll be, as an associate professor at the U, you have a group every year, right?
That I do.
Yeah.
I have a great privilege of teaching 10 students every year in a course called Essentials of Clinical Medicine. So I'm teaching them the first week of medical school how to start talking to patients and how to physically examine them.
Okay.
So they can really, these fundamental, you know, literally how to put a stethoscope in, how to
yeah.
knock on the door and greet a patient. And I mean, really fundamental things, but it's such a great thing to be able to do.
And have you met this year's group yet?
I have. I've had 3 sessions with them, 2 interviewing
wow, already.
Sessions and 1 physical exam session.
Okay, and what is different than when you started doing this?
We didn't do that for a long time. So I think what's so great is that these students start, they've had a white coat ceremony, they've been sort of, you know, introduced into the medical profession in a very beautiful, symbolic way. And rather than waiting for a year, you know,
yeah.
when you're taking all these classes, to actually touch a patient or talk about doing this, we're starting week 1.
Really?
So it really
okay.
keeps their eyes on the prize. So as they're studying biochemistry and gross anatomy and histology and all of that stuff, which can be a little overwhelming at times, this kind of keeps the eyes on the prize.
When it comes to the students, I've always assumed by the time they get to this point, this is a cream of the crop. These are bright young people, high achieving, because they have to be to get into medical school, right?
Oh, my gosh. They are the best of the best. And think about this, too. You know, you think of, like, the great college students. You know, you can have great science students, you can have great humanities students, but to go into medicine and go into healthcare, you really need to be expert in both. I mean, it's the art and science of medicine. You have
okay.
to talk to people, you have to be able to have good IQ, of course, but also good EQ. I think that's incredibly important to be able to read a situation, to know where that person's coming from, to understand that, you know, parents are extremely worried about their sick child or their parents or whoever it might be.
And that aspect of it is important, and that goes beyond grades. It goes beyond just taking chemistry classes, right, and science
yeah.
classes.
Well, and in fact, I mean, this is a different thing, too. So when I applied to medical school in 1988, I had never been in a clinic or a hospital or a nursing home as far as, like, shadowing doctors. I mean, you can't even think about doing that these days. You have to have, just like veterinary medicine, you couldn't even apply to vet school unless you've worked in a vet clinic and you've really worked with animals and know that that's what you want to do.
As an undergrad, you'd have to have done
absolutely.
That.
Or take a year off and do
yeah,
something. But you have
right.
to have some kind of experience. And so there's a case, too. I mean, I just knew I wanted to help people. And that was enough to get me in, along with decent grades and scores and things like that.
We're going to talk more about this process and who the doctors will all be seeing as we all age.
Indeed.
Who those doctors will be as we continue here from the State Fair with Dr. John Hallberg from the University of Minnesota. You know him from All Things Considered, from his 500 medical conversations. We looked back a bit, and we're going to look ahead. We're going to be joined by a doctor who is the co-chair of the Admission Committee at the University of Minnesota. We'll talk about the doctor of the future and what the challenges will be and what the changes will be as we continue. So stay with us as we talk medical topics and the future of medicine with Dr. John Hallberg here on NPR News from the Minnesota State Fair. But first, back to the newsroom in St. Paul for an update from our Phil Picardi. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning, Tom. Vice President Mike Pence is stressing the federal government will support Harvey recovery efforts going forward. In an interview with a Houston radio station today, Pence said the federal government will make the resources available to see Texas through rescue operations and recovery. Pence noted that given the magnitude of the flooding, it will be years coming back. The National Weather Service is warning the flooding that's overwhelming Houston and other parts of Texas will continue to worsen. Weather Service forecasters say up to 20 inches of rain could fall on top of the more than 30 inches some places have already received. Harvey evacuees who have taken shelter in Houston's Convention Center are preparing for what could be several days inside. The storm has left many nearby roads and major highways impassable. Volunteers have been handing out towels, serving food, and setting up tables with donated clothes. A major South Texas airport has reopened. A city statement says Corpus Christi International has resumed commercial air service today. The two major airports in Houston remain closed, however, as heavy rain and flooding continue. Both have been shut down since midday Sunday due to swamped roads leading to those airports. Harvey is now bringing heavy rains to Louisiana as well. In other news, federal investigators have uncovered evidence that more than one in four cases of possible sexual and physical abuse against nursing home patients apparently went unreported to law enforcement authorities. The Health and Human Services Inspector General's office is blaming the Medicare program for failing to enforce a federal law that requires nursing homes to immediately notify police. Medicare says nursing home safety is a top priority. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:36.
I'm Tom Weber. Coming up on NPR News, more on Hurricane Harvey and its aftermath in Houston and elsewhere in the Gulf Coast region. You will hear updates next hour on the show 1A and again at 11 o'clock. Also during the 11 o'clock, you'll hear about a new report that looks into the crisis of famine in Somalia and the Horn of Africa. Stay with NPR News all morning.
Programming is supported by Thomson Reuters, a global enterprise with local roots that supports the essential operating systems for governments, business, and society that can foster a more transparent, fair, and ethical world. Thomson Reuters, the answer company.
Well, it's 9:37, overcast and 63 at the Minnesota State Fairgrounds as we bring you a live broadcast talking medical topics, medical health, where we've been and where we're headed, the future of the doctor, with our doctor, John Hallberg, a familiar voice here on NPR News. We've been talking, looking back at the 500 medical conversations. We're going to look ahead for a few minutes as well as we do that. And we're joined by another guest as well. We're going to talk about what it takes to get into medical school, what you learn there, and who's getting in these days and what their training will be like. But first, I thought we would have a follow-up phone call here, John, when we were talking about one of the big topics that's come up in our 500 conversations, and that is painkillers, opioids, national crisis. So Joe in Mendota Heights just has an observation on that. So you're on NPR News, Joe. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call. I graduated from U of M Medical School in 74. When I graduated from medical school, the average length of stay after a major operation was 7 days. And at that point, a patient could be discharged pain-free. Today, the average length of stay for major operations is 1 or 2 days, sometimes even outpatient, and the goal is to have pain managed at discharge. The key is having how to manage that pain, and like Dr. Hallberg says, being in the trenches, the last thing you want to hear at 2 o'clock in the morning is a call saying, I was just discharged yesterday after surgery, and I'm still having pain, and I need some more of my Percocet. That's why one of the big factors why opioids have been prescribed and probably overprescribed in recently. Thank you for taking the call.
All right. Thank you, Joe.
Yeah, such a great point. I think that that is one of those heart sink phone calls when you're in the call center calls and someone can't get a hold of their surgeon. They gave them just a very tiny number, which is maybe the pushback or the kind of the new reality is you're getting fewer pain medications. And good point, though, is that you typically really can't give people too much on the phone because these are Schedule II medications. So usually the pharmacy will allow us to dispense an emergency quantity, often just 2, 3, 4.
Handful of pills.
Very small amount. Number, and then the next day they need to follow up with you with their surgeon or their primary care provider. But that's a very good point. We spend so much less time in the hospital that it's more of this is managed at home.
Mm-hmm. And that's a good thing that we spend less time in the hospital overall, right?
Absolutely.
For costs and for just
decreased infection rate and all
exactly,
that.
Exactly, all of that. So complicated stuff at 9:40. We're going to welcome another guest here. John is our regular medical analyst, as you know, but we also have someone who is the co-chair of the admissions committee at the University of Minnesota, Dr. Andrew Kiragu. Welcome. It's good to have you here.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here with two of my radio heroes.
Oh, well, thank you very much. You're also, we should say, interim chair of pediatrics at Hennepin County Medical Center. That's your specialty, and associate professor of pediatrics at the U. But as co-chair of the admissions committee, tell us what that process is like for selecting the students. We're talking about, what I understand, about 170 students who are selected every year for medical school.
Yes. In some ways, it's a very challenging process, but also a very enriching and exciting one. We generally have about 4,000 applicants to the medical school. And from that large pool of applicants, we get the 175 medical students.
That's not many out of 4,000. That's a pretty selective rate, right?
Yes, about 4%.
4%.
Yeah.
So,
as Dr. Hallberg said, it's really the cream of the crop.
And so who are those 175?
So in many ways, they come from a variety of different walks of life. All of them have similar characteristics to physicians of the past. We're talking about the history of medicine, the history that we've had. They all want to be healers. These are young men and women, and sometimes older men and women who've elected to go into medicine as a second career, who are really smart, who have histories of service, both human service to others, and also engaged in research really a desire to help their fellow human being.
And how do you screen them to make sure they're the right kind of student for this medical program, and also the right kind of student for the University of Minnesota and what it's doing to train, in a large way, the doctors of the state of Minnesota, right?
So in many ways, and there's a word you might end up hearing a lot with regards to admissions processes into a university, we use what is termed a holistic process. We look at the applicant's grades. Are they smart in terms of is the academic achievement pointing to the ability to be able to handle the rigors of medical school? We also look at their medical experience. Dr. Hallberg pointed out to the fact that when he was applying to med school, exposure to medical experience was not a really big factor, but that is a significant factor.
And that would be exposure either at the undergraduate level or an interest. Do you see even high school kids who have interest in pursuing medicine and so get some practical experience somehow, some way?
Generally, these some may have had experience as a high school student, but generally a lot of these have had experiences through the course of the undergraduate work and some after they've graduated. Mm-hmm. We also look at the applicants' interest and exposures and work in human service.
Okay.
One of the very interesting things is we see a group of applicants who serve not only the communities in which they live, but a broader community, have traveled abroad, have gone to missions in Africa, in Asia, in Central and South America. A lot of the graduates have done outstanding research. A lot of the applicants have done outstanding research, have published in journals, which is something that when Dr. Hallberg and I were applying to med school, wasn't something that necessarily people had to look out for. But now we have applicants to medical school who've published one or more papers in journals.
That's remarkable. And that's changed in what, the last decade?
I would say within the last decade, we've seen more and more of that.
And then also in the last decade, I imagine the applicant pool and the doctors you choose is a more diverse group.
Yes, and that in many ways is one of the goals. It is clear that you increase access to medical care the more diverse your the physicians who are providing the care to patients. But we want to look for applicants from diverse backgrounds, both ethnic and economic. We want to look at applicants who have come from rural Minnesota, interested in working in rural Minnesota, who have an interest in working in urban populations, new immigrant populations.
Is it what we hear in teaching, the teaching profession, that the teachers should, that the students in the class should have teachers who resemble them and they'll learn better? Are there people who feel more comfortable with the doctor who is like them, resembles them or their community, and might be more open to the suggestions of that doctor?
I would say yes and no. I don't know that you necessarily need to have a teacher who looks like you to be able to learn from them. But a teacher who has been exposed to people who look like you, who has lived in a diverse world, who is, the term people might use is culturally competent, that person might be able to interact much better with students and with patients.
And is that something you're also training for, the cultural competence in medical school? Are you looking for it before you even accept students?
One of the things we look at when someone is applying for medical school is what kind of exposure have they had to people who are different than them. For some of this exposure happened in college because they came from a small town in rural Minnesota where they may never have been exposed to people who are different than them. But other people have traveled around the world, and we want to see an example of that. Have they developed relationships with people who are different than them, as opposed to just folks who said, oh, yeah, I went to college and there were people who looked different than me, but I never talked to them, but I knew they were there.
Dr. Andrew Kiragu is assistant professor of pediatrics at the U of M and co-chair of the admissions committee at the University of Minnesota. We're talking about the way the doctor of the future will be selected and trained, along with Dr. John Hallberg here as we broadcast live from the Minnesota State Fair here on Minnesota Public Radio News. And John, as you hear Dr. Kiragu here talking, does this ring true to you in the developments that you've seen in your time teaching at the U?
Oh, yeah. I think back to my class starting in the fall of 1988, people of color, I mean, it was literally probably on one hand that I could think of. It was a huge deal when a classmate came out, you know, at that time, 1988. Yeah. And now I just think of, like, the diversity of in so many ways that comes to the table. I have 10 students right now, and I look at them. Four of the 10 were scribes working in emergency rooms, taking notes for the better part of a year, working with doctors, understanding the language of medicine. The youngest is 22, right out of college, but that's the exception. Every single other person in that room did something else for a few years.
Wow.
One student is 36. She was an anthropology professor at Santa Clara University in California before deciding that she wanted to come back to medical school. And, you know, a Hmong student who went to Harvard, another student went to Bethel. I mean, it's just so rich. It's just so fun to be in a room like that and teaching these future physicians.
And that idea that these young people are coming to you with those, it sounds like in some cases, years of other experience. Is that a fairly recent phenomenon?
It's
than
more
just
recent.
Fresh out of college?
Yeah, I mean, I've been doing this course for about 12 years, and I think that as more and more students come with richer backgrounds, it just adds to the conversation. And in fact, after we're done this fall with this Essentials of Clinical Medicine course showing or working with students in terms of interviewing patients and physically examining them, we then do have some broader topics, bioethical issues and cultural competencies, and really explore that. And I think that that's where that rich background really comes to the fore in terms of rich conversations.
We have a question here. I know both of you are going to like, from Peter in La Crosse, who has a question for our doctors here from the State Fair. So go ahead, Peter. You're on NPR News.
Hi there. Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you just fine.
Hey, I wanted to address students who need to choose an undergraduate major when they're first starting out college. The liberal studies, the humanities and the social sciences, like anthropology, as you guys mentioned, is that a good route to take to prepare for medical school?
All right, Dr. Kiragu.
So one of the beauties of an application to medical school is that you really can take any undergraduate degree. There are some required courses that you would need to take, but we have people who are historians, philosophers, engineers, anthropologists, prior social workers. I mean, just a broad background, and that enriches the practice of medicine. So that should not in any way preclude you from entering into medical school, and you just have to do the required courses and do well on your MCAT.
There's always been this misunderstanding, I think, that students have to major in biology or chemistry or biochemistry. And the counter to that is that if most of the applicants are those majors, it gets harder to set yourself apart because you all start to look the same. So actually, if you're a anthropology major or a sociology major and you've done really well in school and you've taken the prerequisite science classes and have done very well in them, you've taken the MCAT, you've done very well, you have all the other pieces in place, that's a pretty desirable candidate. And that really adds to the richness of the students coming to our classrooms.
We have a question now from our audience here at the State Fair.
My name is Lauren, and I'm from Roseville, Minnesota. I just had a question about what you see as the role for physician assistants and nurse practitioners in the future of medicine.
Good question.
I'll take the first stab at that. So when my clinic, the Mill City Clinic, opened 8-plus years ago, we opened on day one with a nurse practitioner, a physician assistant, and me. And so I think that this is that interprofessional work is absolutely essential. It's definitely the way that we're going. I think that if it's telling, even the new medical building that we're building on campus, this education space, is called the Interprofessional Education Building. And so the idea is that this brand new space is not just for medical students. It's going to be for nursing students, pharmacy students, public health students, dental students. I mean, all of us. So I think there's a very, it's the reality is that I think we're becoming even more and more interprofessional and relying on one another and having, you know, different but complementary roles.
Yeah, and I would like to agree with Dr. Holberg. Physician assistants, nurse practitioners play an integral role in the provision of care across the spectrum, whether it's in pediatrics, in surgery, in the critical care units. And so they're an integral part. And we've had, over time, it's just a different way of thinking about these advanced practice providers.
Another question from our audience here at the Minnesota State Fair.
Yes. Hi, my name is Dale, and I'm from Plymouth. So whenever I try to get in with a specialist doctor, like a dermatologist or a gastroenterologist, it seems to take forever to be able to get an appointment. So I was wondering if going forward there'll be more of these doctors, specialists, available for us to see.
That's right, a really interesting question.
You know, I've had that experience.
I mean, so on one level, it's a little self-serving, if I may say. I think dermatologists want to preserve salary levels and income. I mean, that sounds, you know, a little negative, but it's true. That's one of the most difficult specialties to match into when you're a medical student. If you want to do ophthalmology, dermatology, things like that are highly desirable. The lifestyle is good. The pay is high. So that's one thing. And then I think in the case of gastroenterologists and other specialists, that's tricky. I mean, it's a struggle. We're a pediatrician and a family physician up here, and I think we know the struggles we have of just, we want to provide a base with great access for the majority of people for the majority of the time and the majority of their conditions. And then it's kind of like a pyramid scheme where you kind of trickle upward to get to the specialist. I think this might be a good point.
Are there just fewer?
There are fewer specialists.
Is that part of it? Yeah.
But this is where I think we are starting to find that people are willing, you know, a nurse practitioner or a PA working in those offices. Some patients will refuse to see anyone but a doctor. Frankly, that's silly because these are wonderful, highly qualified people. And frankly, they're in a niche. They know a lot. They know more than I do as a family physician about that particular niche. And as a way to get into that clinic and get the workup going and to get things underway, boy, is that a great way to do it. So I think that being open to that possibility is important. And that's actually a direction I think we'll be heading in.
And Dr. Carrago, in specialties versus family medicine, pediatrics, broader disciplines.
So one of the things that we have seen, of course, because of the higher remuneration for a specialist versus primary care provider, is some more interest in subspecialty practice. However, because of a longer training time, you still have the problem of fewer specialist providers than primary care. And this will continue, unfortunately. By 2025, there's estimated to be almost, I think it's close to 90,000 fewer physicians needed across our country. So there's going to be a need to increase the number of providers.
So at the training level, how do you address that need? Do you get more students into medical schools? Do you widen the pool that way? Do you get ahead of it earlier with college students and say, we need doctors and you've got to be one? How do you do it?
Well, A and B.
Really?
You want to encourage more capable students to apply to medical school over time to meet this gap. The number of students that are admitted to medical school are actually slowly increasing to try and meet this gap. In terms of specialty or subspecialty interest, that really is dependent on the individual.
And the pool of med students you have. Just with a couple of minutes left here from each of you, I want to know what, when you look at that, even if there is a shortage of doctors, when you see this current crop of medical students in their training, what are you looking most forward to, Dr. Quiroga?
So for me, I'm actually really excited about the people who are applying to medical school. I mean, we see a group of young people who are excited about serving others. To see the number of students actually interested in serving, not only in the community in which they live, but around the world, I mean, I think is really exciting. The fact that so many are interested in research, so many are developing new treatments, new cures. I mean, medicine has changed just in the time since I've been practicing. Medicine has changed significantly. Think about a disease like AIDS. When I started med school, AIDS was a death sentence. Now, in many ways, it's a chronic disease.
Dr. Quiroga, I'm afraid we're getting close on time here. Dr. Andrew Quiroga, Assistant Professor of Pediatrics at the U and Co-Chair of the Admissions Committee at the University of Minnesota, thank you for the insight into the doctors of the future. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thanks for appearing with us here at the State Fair. And Dr. John Hallberg from the University of Minnesota, the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health. Always a pleasure. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Tom, for the privilege.
We hope to do it again at the Minnesota State Fair. You're listening to Minnesota Public Radio News. I'm Tom Cran. Stay tuned.